Welcome back to Real World Rewind. As always, I am your host, Blaine Grimes, and joining me on today's show is Alexis Johnson from Real Cathedral. Hey, Alexis.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show. And you guys, our listeners, voted last time, and you picked which film we're going to talk about today. And the polls were really, really close. In fact, I think our winning film only won by one vote, if I'm correct. So thanks for participating, and you all selected The Shawshank Redemption. So we are going to talk about The Shawshank Redemption here today on the show. Just a couple, or just a little quick overview. Shawshank Redemption was released in 1994. It was directed by Frank Darabont, who you probably know from some other Spielberg adaptations like The Green Mile, The Mist, and he was also the showrunner for The Walking Dead for a number of years. So Frank Darabont is our director. It, of course, stars Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman. It was nominated for 7 Oscars. It won none of them. Did not win an Oscar, and this is a fantastic film, and maybe we'll tease out some of why this film might not have won an Oscar through our conversation today. But I just want to jump right in and ask you a question, Alexis. When did you first see this movie? How'd you first hear about it? How'd you come across The Shawshank Redemption?
Well, I watched films, I mean, even adult films when I was a child. So when this movie came out, I was about 9. That ages me, I guess, but yeah, I was about 9 in 1994. And then I didn't see it that year, though. I think I was about 13 when I saw that. And I remember I'd go to a friend's house. She was a big movie buff, too. And that was the first time I saw this film. And I remember just being, you know, totally floored by it. So, yeah, even as a teenager, it really struck me.
Yeah. And so do you like Stephen King adaptations? Have you seen any other adaptations of King's work? And how would you rank Shawshank in terms of an adaptation of King's work?
Well, I'm honestly not the biggest Stephen King fan. The two that I love are the prison ones, which is Shawshank and The Green Mile. I love both those films. Shawshank is definitely a little bit better, but I still think The Green Mile is an excellent film. I saw The Mist, too, but I wasn't, like, as obsessed with it as some of my friends were. But Stephen King's just kind of weird. Like, you either really like his stuff or you kind of don't. So I'm not really into his horror or any of that other kind of stuff.
Yeah, I am a big King fan. I've read more of his stuff within the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years than I have some of his older stuff. And I enjoy a lot of the adaptation of his work. I'm kind of like you, The Mist. You know, I'm fine with it. It's not one of my favorites. I've got a friend who loves The Mist. That's not my favorite. I think Shawshank, or not I think, but Shawshank definitely is my favorite. And The Green Mile is really solid, too. And it's funny how King always gets this reputation as this great horror writer. And he is. But he writes a lot of things that aren't really necessarily horror either.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think of The Shawshank Redemption as a Stephen King novel, or I think it's a short story or a novella called Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, I think, is the actual
title. Yeah, I just looked that up before we got on, so yeah, that is what it's called. Is
1163.
That's, I'm terrible. That's his, right? That's an adaptation.
Yeah, that's right. I haven't read that one, okay. but I did enjoy the TV series, which I heard was quite different. But yeah, it was enjoyable. So this this seems like this is at the top of our list as far as adaptations of King's work goes. Dreamcatcher was atrocious. I don't know if you.
Oh God! I worked at the movie theaters when that movie came out. It was so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I saw this movie when I was young, so I was. It came out in 1994. I probably saw it when I was 10. This was not in 1994, but it was on. Mm-hmm. It was on TV, so I'm sure it was heavily edited. And I was probably a little bit too young to deal with some of the more intense subject matter in there, even at 10. But I've mentioned before on this podcast how my parents didn't really exercise discretion in what they let me watch. But I was really drawn in by it, even as a little kid, which you would think a 2.5-hour drama wouldn't be that fascinating to a 10-year-old. And for some reason, this one really captivated me. And it's stuck with me since I was about 10 or so. So it's really exciting to get to talk about it and revisit it as an adult. It had probably been 3 or 4 years since I'd seen it until getting ready for this podcast. So that's really exciting. There's also some...
Yeah, it is awesome.
It is. It's really interesting, too, how I was doing some research, and this movie was shot all throughout Ohio, and of course the Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield is the location they used for at least a lot of the exterior of the prison. And it's, I don't know, have you heard any about the reputation of the Ohio State Reformatory at all?
No, I haven't.
So supposedly it's haunted. Which is, it's just kind of funny doing a King work. It's one of these famous haunted prisons, and this is where they shot this movie that really doesn't have a lot supernatural going on. And I just think it's kind of one of those funny coincidences that happens. But it's a perfect location for this movie, and the prison is just gorgeous. And I know Frank Darabont has talked about how he always wanted in every shot where you see Andy and Red outside talking or anybody outside in the prison yard talking to have the Ohio State Reformatory in the background and make you feel closed in this gray prison wall.
Yeah, that's definitely comes across in the film.
Yeah. So another question. This movie is called The Shawshank Redemption, the emphasis on redemption. And I just want to ask you, who or what is redeemed in this movie? Where do we see this theme or this idea of redemption on display here?
Oh gosh, all over the place. It's kind of odd because the main character, he didn't actually do anything wrong,
right.
But he's still redeemed because he kind of realizes what he did do wrong in his marriage, even though it wasn't what he went to prison for. He sort of looks back and sees how he pulled away from his wife and how he didn't really participate in his life to the fullest that like he could have. He worked at a bank. He sort of had this monotonous routine and didn't really pay attention to anything, even her. And that's kind of part of his redemption. But I think Red and some of the other characters, just by being around Andy and the kind of person he is, get redeemed through that. And then the prison, for me, the most obvious one was the prison system and the law, because it was so corrupt, and Andy helped kind of expose a lot of the corruption, a lot of the abuse, a lot of the money laundering, all the kind of stuff that was going on. So this corrupt institution, which is supposed to, you know, help reform people to society or help them serve their sentence, was just as bad as its prisoners. And through Andy's slow but very meticulous way of bringing it down, we were able to expose that. So Shawshank itself is redeemed, which is really interesting.
That's really good. And that's really insightful what you said about Andy, because I thought a lot about his character and how maybe we see his character redeemed or something, or him bring about redemption. And I hadn't really thought about the aspect that you brought up about his life and the way he lived his life prior to going into prison, and how there's sort of a redemption in the sense that it's not until he gets into prison and this terrible injustice happens to him that he's able to start to make he's able to start making the most out of the gifts that he has and the talents that he has. I'm trying to think of examples. I mean, what do we see him doing in the prison that where he's actually using his potential or using his gifts? We know he starts the library, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then that helps his fellow inmates learn. Some of them didn't really know how to read, or it kind of brings literature to them, brings a sense of class to them when they're in this terrible place. And then just in general, with libraries kind of a way of doing it, but incredibly good with numbers, incredibly good with organization. So he becomes the warden's basically chief, accountant, you know, but it's all under the table because obviously you can't employ a prisoner.
Right.
But, so he uses a lot of that, but I think his culture and his taste and the way he brings art to the prisoners and the way he brings literature to the prisoners is one of the best examples of how he uses his talents.
Yeah. And educating his, you know, his fellow prisoners as he makes friends in there. It's interesting too, how you mentioned him being an agent used to redeem the prison system itself, right? None of this would have happened if Andy, you know, were not wrongfully accused. I think it's interesting, and one of the reasons this movie is so powerful is that it speaks to how situations in our life, when they look terribly unjust, or even when they are terribly unjust and terrible things are happening, there can still be redemption brought about through those situations and those circumstances. which of course speaks powerfully absolutely. To us as Christians, because that's exactly what happens in the cross of Christ, right? When you don't expect a savior to become flesh or to live on this earth for 30 years or to, you know, suffer the injustice of being crucified in the most, you know, dishonoring way you could die then. And that being the pathway to redemption. You don't expect that.
Yes, absolutely. I think of Joseph a lot, too, in this story, Joseph's imprisonment in Egypt. Well, first of all, being, you know, tossed aside by his brothers and left for dead, becoming a slave. And then he's imprisoned, you know, by the Pharaoh, and his wife sort of lies about their relationship. So he gets thrown into this awful place for a long time, and a whole bunch of horrible things happen to him. But just like Andy, if those things hadn't have happened, you know, when he tells his brothers in the end, one of my favorite lines in the Bible, like, what you intended for evil, God used for good and the saving of many lives. So Joseph was strategically put there to later do something great. And I think it's very similar for Andy's journey.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a question that I hadn't really planned, so I might be catching you a little off guard, and it's okay if you don't have an immediate answer. But Brooks's storyline to me is always one of the more affecting and just really sad parts of the story, because he goes out and then, you know, doesn't know how to adjust to life outside the prison, because he's basically lived his whole life in there. And then of course he ends up hanging himself. What do we make of that? How might that fit into this idea of redemption that we're talking about?
Oh gosh. You know, that's something I've thought about for a long time, and I really don't have an answer for. Let me think. Do you have any ideas?
I don't.
I always think about that character and kind of what his purpose is. But I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with choice and with who you are as a person as well. Because Andy and Red, although they didn't go through it as long, or I guess Red would be a better example because he was older and had gone through prison longer than Andy had. And he was let out the same way and ended up getting the same job. And he found a way to acclimate, you know, he kind of chose to not let it get him down, and he chose to keep going and move forward. So I think you see a big contrast between what happens to Brooke and what happens to Red. Cause you know, they both go to that spot where he hung himself and it says Brooks was here. And then it says, and then Red carves his name, Red was here, but then he walks away from that. So I always think about that. Like, what can I glean from that? But I still haven't come up with anything really solid. So yeah. I don't think I can answer.
It's always, no, that's okay. I sprung that on you, and it's always seemed really enigmatic to me and just elusive, even though I think about Brooks a lot after I watch this movie, and it's just always on my mind, you know, thinking about it as before it happens when I watch this movie. And I guess maybe I like what you said. And I think maybe there's also this element of he's another character that shows the brokenness of the prison system. So it may be a little bit of an indictment of the prison system that is then redeemed or fixed, at least on the small scale for this movie, because ideally a prison we would think of as a reformatory. In fact, like I mentioned, the prison that this shot at, the actual prison, is called Ohio State Reformatory. So the idea of reformatory has this connotation that we're taking individuals who are broken in some way, who have broken the law, and we're reshaping them, ideally to be able to integrate back into society better eventually. And so when someone's released, they're supposed to be somewhat equipped to fit back into society, but the prison system hasn't done that for Brooks entirely. Yeah. I get that, like you've mentioned, it's very true that he certainly makes some choices. He makes some choices that help it not work, but fundamentally the prison hasn't equipped him for society.
Well, no, it made him codependent.
Right.
So, yeah, although it wasn't all entirely his choice at all, not, by any means. But, yeah, the prison system doesn't really help you stand on your own. It makes you codependent to the system. But since, you know, Andy thinks totally outside the box, so for him that wasn't really ever probably going to be an issue. But for Red, he's somewhere between Andy and Brooks. So it's kind of like you're almost wondering which way he's going to go, because you can, you know where Andy's going to go. You just know it just from his character and the perseverance he has. But, you know, when Red gets out, you're not really sure what's going to happen to him. And I think that that's kind of cool, too. More, it makes it a little bit more interesting for his character.
Yeah, it certainly does. What else sticks out to you on a thematic level, maybe aside from this idea of redemption?
Well, there's definitely a brotherhood aspect between Red and Andy. That's, well, I mean, pretty much anyone in Andy, just because he kind of has an openness to him that welcomes others. But, you know, with Red, it's kind of like prison was just almost like a game to him. And he didn't really take everything too seriously there, but he sort of saw Andy as like looking at the world in a different way and being able to see the beauty and the ugliness, because Red's a bit more practical. Mm-hmm. So I think this brotherhood kind of unites these two different kinds of people, and they develop really close, or develop to be really close. And I always thought that was cool because, you know, I'm a girl, but I'm a sucker for a good bromance. Like, that's one of my favorite things to see in literature and film and TV. I just love it because I just like the idea, you know, Lord of the Rings, all that kind of stuff, where you can go back and look at this relationship. And it's just so, what's the word, the Greek word for, it's more based in that. It's a brotherly love. It's a brotherly.
Oh, is it phileo?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So yeah, it's really, that's kind of what I always think of too, is you always see the two of them in like a picture or the poster or something. And
right.
I always think of their brotherly relationship.
Yeah. It's funny that, I mean, we just finished with Lord of the Rings trilogy and going through those movies, and obviously brotherhood and community and a bond between, you know, Frodo and Sam especially is really important there. And so we're getting that again. I don't know if I'm doing this subconsciously, if we're getting these movies where we have these really strong connections, but yeah, that's a great thing. That's a great thing to point out. One thing I had never noticed about this movie, and it's really hard to spot. I was watching the movie with, the director's commentary on, and Darabont brought out something very, very interesting. The scene where the prisoners are all sitting together in the movie theater watching the Rita Hayworth movie.
Oh, yeah.
On the background, there's actually a painted mural on the wall. And Darabont said that that's actually a mural of Jesus. And the light from the projector is actually coming out of his heart. So you've got literally the light of Christ shining before all of these men, which certainly fits into to our themes that we've been talking about. And I had never, ever noticed that before. In fact, I still had to pause it when he said it because I couldn't quite spot it. It's fairly quick. But I thought that was really fascinating, and so glad that we have things like director's commentaries to point us out to, you know, things like that we can't see initially.
Yeah, that's really cool. Like, I would never have noticed that either. And that's cool that he brought up, you know, that kind of the reason for that and everything. I tried to look up some trivia, some interesting things about this film too, you know, regarding that. I know it's Morgan Freeman's favorite movie that he's made, supposedly. Oh, okay. Which that doesn't really surprise me because it's really, really good.
So, right.
Yeah.
Right. I know Darabont also mentioned that there are a couple of what they call insert shots, and these are things that are typically filmed after principal photography is wrapped. They just need a couple of extra shots to sort of make narrative connections or make a, you know, beat in a scene work. And so there's a scene early in the movie where you see a close-up of Andy's hand reaching into the glove box to get a flask out of the car, or out of the glove box of the car. And then you also see Andy writing his name on the prison wall with the little rock tool, and that's where the rock chips out, and he figures out he can tunnel through it. Those are actually director Frank Darabont's hands in both of those instances. They shot those after they had done principal photography. And so those are the director's hands there doing all that work. I thought that was also very interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. Directors do that sometimes. Going back to Brooks, that I guess this might've been the short film, but I was just scrolling through IMDb right now, looking at the some of the facts. They say it's never stated directly in the film, according to IMDb, but Brooke's in prison for allegedly murdering his wife and daughter after a losing streak in poker. So that kind of adds a lot of darkness to that character. Mm. But they didn't mention that in the film, so I wonder... I guess I'd have to read the short story to see what his fate is in the short story, but just kind of going back to them, that kind of adds a little bit of hopelessness. So that's kind of sad and depressing, but maybe that's kind of why King and the screenwriter wrote it that way. I'm not sure. But
yeah, anyway, that's really interesting.
Thought I'd throw that out there.
Yeah, I did not know that at all. So what, since you're a screenwriter, mm-hmm. what is a screenwriter... Or what can you as a screenwriter point out to us that maybe we wouldn't see that makes this movie so effective? I mean, all these people voted for this movie. This is the one they want to hear. What can you tell us about that as a screenwriter? Why does this have such an appeal for us?
Well, when you're writing, I think in the screenplays are very simplistic. You do want to have some good description. You want to have good visuals written out there for sure. It's mostly about describing what the shot is rather than telling someone how to make the shot happen. Mm-hmm. But I think definitely using between how they wrote it out and the cinematographer's use of showing the prison, mm-hmm. I think played a key role, but I think a lot of that was in description too. And then obviously dialogue is huge in script writing. And I think this film was incredibly well written because of the developing relationships between Red and his fellow inmate, Andy and Red and the fellow inmates. Even though Andy's actually a man of very few words, and most of the words are coming from Red, right. And I think that's also a good writer choice too, to view the sort of the protagonist in the light of a secondary character is always really good idea. So that's just a little bit of it. This is one I've actually wanted to purchase. They do sell it on Amazon, a little book of it. So it's going to come into my collection eventually.
Yeah. And I think, like you mentioned, you kind of hinted at this, it's kind of this confluence of not just a great screenplay, but great cinematography, great art direction, you know, great directing, all of these things. I know Frank Darabont himself was disappointed that the production designer and set decorator Terry Marsh and Michael Sheridan, respectively, didn't receive Oscar nominations for their work here. Mm-hmm. Because Darabont said, well, people just assumed, because we're shooting at Ohio State Reformatory, it's a real prison, people just assumed that they walked into an old prison and just started shooting things. But there was a ton of work that had to be done to make the prison presentable, to make it look like we think a prison should look. So, for instance, that huge cell block that you see all of the prisoners standing down in several times, for instance, the night or the morning after Andy escapes, that was a set. That wasn't something in the prison. So this is something they actually constructed, and I guess I had never really thought about that before.
Well, yeah, you definitely have to. I've been on many sets, like, you know, small film sets, because mm-hmm. that's what I did in school, but also just helping. And lighting is so crucial and set is so crucial that even if you could just walk into a place and use it, you would have to do so much to make it look good on film. And especially during this time when it was actual film, oh gosh, you know, lighting can make or break the final product. So that's kind of why you're seeing, you know, that, oh yeah, it takes so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when, like you said, when you're shooting on location, a lot of times people just don't realize how much you have to do that's artificial to make it look quote unquote real. It's always really fascinating to see how those things work out. But the production design in this film is just seamless. And Roger Deakins, like I mentioned, he's an amazing cinematographer. And
okay, he's the king.
I would just give him awards for everything. So
absolutely.
Is there anything you noticed? Let me ask you this question first. How long had it been since you had seen this movie before you watched it getting ready for the podcast?
Several years. Probably getting close to like 8 or 9, and not like a while, probably like 8 years or something.
Okay.
So I think I watched it I think I watched it during film school. So that was in 2008. So yeah, about 8 years. Wow. Jeez. Time is flying. That was when I started in 2008. But yeah, that's probably around the same time I would have watched it, 8 or 9. So yeah, that's crazy. But yeah. I watched it repeatedly when I was younger, just because I would show it to people. I'm one of those, you have to sit down and watch a movie and show it to them and experience with them people.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, so definitely I did watch it many times before that.
Yeah. Was there anything that stuck out to you then this time that you hadn't necessarily noticed before? You had this epiphany of, oh, I hadn't thought about it like that.
Oh, that happens every time I watch anything I love. But yeah, that I think especially having now gone through film school and also just living some more of life and like going through some harder things in life, I found the characters, I found I could relate to them more. And I think the brokenness of the people, it's like they make a lot of jokes and it's funny, you know, like, oh, just kind of making fun of the prisoners and that kind of stuff. But I think they're all very real to me. And I think that's something I might not have noticed the first time, because when you're a kid, you kind of have stars in your eyes about movies and it's more imaginative to you. But as you grow older and you've gone through some things, you can really connect and relate to a lot of the characters or situations, and you can see parts of yourself and other people in them. And I think that that's also a factor of really good writing.
Absolutely. And that's a sign you've got a good movie too, when you can come back to it multiple times over the years and you get something different out of it every single time. I think that's how you know mm-hmm. you're getting on something that either is a classic or at least is certainly worthwhile. I frankly would be surprised if 50 years from now we weren't still watching and talking about Shawshank. I think it's that quality of a movie.
I agree. I can't believe it didn't do well. I'm sure you knew this, but it didn't do well at the box office, but it became one of the most highly rented films of all time.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Crazy.
I mean, nobody went to see it in theaters. A movie like this is a perfect illustration of how a movie that doesn't win awards, right? Sure, it got nominated sometimes, mm-hmm. but didn't win, and didn't get seen when it was in theaters. We're now talking about it, and I think obviously everybody voted for it, so we recognize that it's a great movie, but it's something that we probably wouldn't be talking about if we just wanted to go by initial critic reaction to it. So I think it's always important to temper our sort of our immediate gut reaction to and give these things some time. I know C.S. Lewis said you've got to wait 100 years to see whether something's a classic or not, so sometimes we need to be maybe a little bit less reactionary. Myself, like I said, myself included, certainly.
Yeah. Well, and also you have to think about sometimes great films get completely eclipsed by other good movies, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I know 1994, I believe, was the year of Forrest Gump as well.
It was.
Which is also a film I really love. And I think that might have eclipsed Shawshank's beauty and potential and all that kind of stuff. So that's why later people were like, oh, I never did get to see this. And then everyone's just wowed by it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of sad and unfortunate. But the thing is, yeah, like you said, we're still talking about it. So to me, that works out in its favor.
Right. And it's also, I think, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction was 1994. So,
yes, it was.
Some really strong contenders. Nevertheless, frankly, if I had to pick one, I would pick Shawshank. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people would pick Tarantino's over that, but Shawshank just has a special place in my heart, and I think it's a really special film. Any final thoughts about this film for us today?
Well, if you haven't seen it, we just spoiled everything for you, but if you haven't seen it, this is a film I would say is on like a must-see film by anybody, by any means, because it hits all the points of great filmmaking and great writing, but also, yeah, the story, the redemption, the themes in it are so, like, they'll just hit you in ways you would never expect. They're so good, and no matter how many times we've said that, like, you know, how many times we've seen this film, every time I get something new out of it, and I feel the same emotions, only stronger almost, every time I watch the film, so I would highly recommend you see it or watch it again if you kind of watched it when you were 12 and don't remember and
right.
need a refresher.
Right.
That's my final thoughts. It's
yeah.
a must-see.
I would second all of that. It's something, like you said, you experience things, and I love the way you put it, more powerfully every time you see it. And that's exactly true. Mm-hmm. The longer you get to know people and the deeper relationships you have and the older you get, the more you find in this movie and the richer it becomes. Great movie. Please, please, please do see it if you haven't. Or watch it again, even if you have. And let us know in the comments what you found that you didn't see. And if you've got any great thoughts about Brooks, please do send comments about Brooks, because he's a fascinating character, and I'd love to think more about his redemption or lack thereof.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I would say, too. Leave us some comments.
Yeah. So, Alexis, where can we find you on your website and social media? How can we connect with you and see your work?
My website's Real Cathedral, real as in film real, of course, .net. And my Twitter handle is Phoenician Rises. And it'll be under my name, though, Alexis Johnson. And those are the top places that you can find me. Real Cathedral also has a Facebook page that you can follow and like as well. But definitely follow me on Twitter. I love to communicate on Twitter, and definitely hit up the website sometime.
Great. Yeah, please do all of those things. Connect with her. Read some of her great stuff. Thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great.
And you can find me on Twitter. Until next time, though, thank you for rewinding with us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!